Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Listeners of Sons of Patriarchy, Peter Bell here, producer of the podcast. Just so you know, we are turning ads on for this series, and the reason is simple. We need to cover our costs. It takes a lot of money to run this, as everything has been self-funded up to this point. We ran this past the Sons of Patriarchy team, as well as the Survivor community, and we have received the green light to act on this decision. These ads will not be intrusive, nor will they be random. They will occur at the beginning and end of each episode. There will be no interruptions during the content of each. With this decision, we are earmarking 25% of the revenue these ads generate towards outreach, which exclusively provides resources for survivors of the movements we are exposing and profiling. The rest will go to cover our costs and our time in producing this series. If you would like to donate directly to our efforts, find the outreach link in the show notes. There you can give a single or recurring donation. Along with this, we are turning on Apple subscriptions. $4.99 per month will give you access to ad-free listening. You can also sign up for the same on our Patreon account, link in the show notes. Now, let's get on with the episode. Christian nationalism. What an odd pairing of two words that seem so diametrically opposed. The religion that I, along with a few billion others across the world, adhered to, linked with a movement glued by a common set of loves, laws, and traditions. Now, that may not seem odd to you, nor might it seem particularly unchristian. Don't all Christians share the same loves, laws, and traditions? While our allegiance to the Redeemer remains the same across culture, time, skin color, and tradition, the way these manifest in our lives, families, and communities do differ. With the ascendancy of Donald Trump as President of the United States of America in 2017, Christian nationalism and nationalists joined him at the hip. Sure, politics and religion have always been bedfellows, trying to figure out who could snag the majority of the bed cover and leave the other in the cold. But the nationwide imposition of a certain sect of the Christian tradition and the political power to make it happen gained recognition. Presidential hopefuls would make known their religious bona fides, but that was more to assuage the public than to coerce them. So, when the nationalists of the Christian flavor signed at the bottom of the Trump ticket, many were left wondering, where did you come from? We'd always bickered about the relationship, but never thought the unit of state and church would give birth to this. As far as I can tell, there are three groups dealing with these complex issues. One, those who, like me, had their head in the sand up until Trump, and Christian nationalism blindsided us. Two, those who love God and country, truly, and sort of assumed, hasn't this always been the case? We lost it and we need it back. And three, what we're seeing now is a response to a failed system. We need to scrap it and start it anew. So, what's the real story? Where did these ideas come from? Who are they associated with? How do they work on the ground? How have they morphed over the centuries to their present form today? Or better yet, is what we have today the natural result of centuries of political and religious thought, or is it something different? Where did all these nationalists come from? How has Christianity been co-opted or confused in political discourse? Who are the forebears of modern-day Christian nationalists, and how might this help us better understand where it's going? In order to grapple with these issues, we have to go back, way back, so that we can move forward. Welcome to Episode 4, The Roots of Nationalism. If you're anything like me, you've never heard of the term Catholic integralism. But the integralists are key to understanding their Protestant analogs, the reaction to the Catholic state and papal overlord. We'll look into the beginnings of integralism, the reform reaction to the same, the theocratic projects, and how robust Protestantism was key to the formation of a constitutional republic, the modern democratic nation. If you're a Christian, we'll help equip you to navigate the waters of the current Christian nationalist debate. If you're not a Christian, we'll show you why you should care and how Christians developed modern-day pluralistic democracies, the freedom for religion, individual rights, and freedom of conscience. Let's begin with one of the world's foremost scholars on the movement formed centuries before that thing we call nationalism.
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I'm grateful to be able to talk about this. You know, most of my work has been in the Catholic area of these thoughts and the point of your series. So hopefully I can add something distinctive. So my name is Kevin Vallier. I'm a professor of philosophy newly at the University of Toledo. And I work primarily within liberal political thought and its sort of encounter with religious points of view and traditional religious institutions. So a lot of my earliest work, I got my PhD in 2011. My first book was on called Liberal Politics and Public Faith, trying to advance a kind of limited government or classical liberal approach to religion and public life that was neither Christian nationalist or what have you, but also not kind of secular liberal. I've done a lot of work on trust and polarization, but my most recent book, All the Kingdoms of the World, on Radical Religious Alternatives to Liberalism, came out with Oxford University Press last year. And the purpose of that book was to, as a kind of person who believes the broadly liberal political tradition, not liberalism as a kind of way of life, but more liberalism as a set of principles that how government should be structured in terms of constitutional democracy, the protection of constitutional rights through law, the free market and social safety nets, ideas that liberals kind of brought together in a kind of broader political philosophy. And I wanted to look at the revival of forms of what I called religious anti-liberalism, which were sort of theologically based doctrines that were posed for kind of wholesale replacement of liberal political order. And I looked across different religions, focused primarily on this doctrine of Catholic integralism that we'll talk about. I didn't get into Christian nationalism because, to be frank, it's a lot more intellectually thin than Catholic integralism, because Catholic integralism has some of the best Catholic theologians in history behind it over the last 1,000 years, really from the 11th century at least down to the 19th century. So there was a huge amount of depth to get into. And then I looked at Sunni Islam and I looked at Chinese Confucianism. So it's interesting. I haven't really worked as much on Christian nationalism, but I've been in that general vicinity for a long time.
Christian nationalism, liberal democracy, Catholic integralism, and more. We'll get into all these issues, their interrelationships, their competing ideas, and the thinness of some of their arguments. I wonder if you caught what Dr. Vallier just said. I haven't spent much time on Christian nationalism because its intellectual thought is so thin, both because its proponents are so few and their arguments weak. Why does Dr. Vallier care about Christian nationalism? Well, because of Doug Wilson.
I've heard about him. I never really looked into his work, in part because I wasn't clear how much he differed from the older Christian Reconstructionists, like R.J. Rashtuni and Gary North, whose views I was more familiar with. And you know, I mean, Gary North was extraordinarily prolific. I mean, and Rashtuni too. So I just thought, well, if I wanted to understand, I feel like I understand Wilson's views because I understood those other views. So it just didn't seem to me particularly, like I could always read a Catholic or a Hindu nationalist or, you know, another Confucian. It just seemed like, or Eastern Orthodox. I mean, so it just always, it never quite, his stuff never quite rose up on my list. I did see a clip of him at the recent NatCon. And I thought he was in a difficult position when Yoram Hazony, who's a Jewish philosopher, was interviewing him. When he said, oh, well, look, we should have a Christian nation and so on. And, you know, people should have to sort of respect Christianity in public life. And then, you know, Hazony asked about the Jews and like, oh, no, Jews will be totally respected. And so I don't really know how to square that. I think our kind of bone in the throat of Christian nationalism is it's you just ask, well, are Jews equal citizens in a Christian nationalist order? If they are equal citizens, it doesn't look so Christian nationalist. If they aren't, Christian nationalism starts to look pretty nasty.
You can't speak out of both sides of your mouth, making the Christian nationalists and liberal democracy happy at the same time. If everyone has full citizenships and rights, you aren't Christian nationalist. If they don't have access to the same, things look pretty nasty. Dr. Valier puts his finger on the pulse and starts pressing throughout this episode. He holds the Reconstructionist and Nationalist feet over the fire and asks, "What do you really believe? Let's bring this to its logical, destructive end." We haven't talked about Catholic integralism yet. My guess is you've never heard this term, and neither had I, before I talked to Dr. Valier. So, what is it?
So first a bit on the relevance before I define it. I see the Catholic integralists as having moved first and opening the door for Protestants to explore Christian nationalism more openly.
Yeah.
So they kind of were the first people who kind of struck gold in terms of younger Christians being interested in kind of Christ-focused politics. And so even though they were small in number, their level of intellectual sophistication was high enough that I think their ideas started to spread, also their social media presence. And so I'm not sure there would be people calling themselves Christian nationalists today unless there were people calling themselves Catholic integralists 10 years ago. I think that's just the direction of influence. Because it was the Catholics that struck on this first. Okay, so like that's why your listeners should care about this movement.
Yep.
So there are two principles that Christian nationalists, integralists, and I think most Christians can accept about political life, which is that authority, political authority, originates in God, ultimately, even if it passes through the people. And we have sort of two principles, the first of which is that, you know, God establishes the state to promote the common good of the human community, widely held, and that God establishes the church to preach the gospel and to mentor or and to minister to the baptized to promote their ultimate or eternal good.
Yep.
Right. So those are, you know, very, very common beliefs. And of course, the Catholic version has a Catholic notion of the common good in terms of natural law and kind of socially conservative, maybe more economically left-leaning views. And of course, it has a very detailed and specific ecclesiologies in terms of what it thinks the church is.
Yep.
Okay. So Catholic integralism accepts those first two principles in their Catholic form. No big deal there. No problem there. Nothing unusual, nothing foreign. But in the High Middle Ages in particular, the idea of a full church-state separation was just not on their radar.
Not
they didn't even see the point of it because everyone was Catholic unless you were in the Byzantine Empire and then the lines of division weren't as sharp as they are today, anywhere near as sharp. And it's also just seemed obvious that if the state is responsible for promoting the good, that the church should guide it because the church understands the eternal good and has authority over it. So the big question, really high in late Middle Ages and really even after the Reformation, was how are these two powers to be integrated? What is their relationship to be one another? Now, we know from scripture and tradition two things. One, God authorizes the state before he creates the church on earth.
Yep.
There's a direct divine authorization of the state. That is, its sovereignty is not derived from the church. And the reverse is also true. The church's authority does not derive from the state in any respect. It derives directly from God. So God has created these two powers to govern human beings. Okay, so we're not in weird territory. So how does the integration work? Well, it can't be that one has direct power over the other. So it can't be an Anglican relationship, for instance, a traditional, say, 16th century variety. And it can't be a pure theocracy either. So the church can't say, oh, well, look, people need to eat to go to mass, so we'll take over agricultural policy. And so a number of people, really, I would say, following in the 11th century, but as those relationships of integration broke down, it's really the 16th and 17th centuries that you start to see a new doctrine emerge, or at least a new articulation of the old doctrine. What was called by many theologians of that time, the indirect power of the Pope.
Yeah.
So the Pope doesn't have direct power over the state and able to tell it what to do in general. But there are cases in which state policy can bear on spiritual policy, affected, for instance, in terms of what communications it allows, what education it allows. And the thought was that owing to the church's nobler end of salvation rather than earthly flourishing, it could deputize the state to help advance its spiritual mission.
Yep.
Now, once you get into specifics, it's things like, so the church has its own law, the canon law, and it could say excommunicate people after they're tried and convicted of heresy. The integralist would say, well, look, in many cases, that can be backed up by state power. So, you know, on the one hand, you excommunicate a heretic, and if they don't come around, then you can imprison them or maybe execute them. So in essence, what makes integralism distinct is this third condition, that is the indirect sovereignty, the indirect spiritual sovereignty of this church over the state. It is indirect. This is not theocracy. It's sort of quasi-theocracy, but it is an integration of the church's law and the state's law to pursue the sort of whole human good. So that's what Catholic integralism is. That's what it means.
There would be no Christian nationalism had Catholic integralism not risen up in the early centuries of the second millennium. Yes, there were seedlings in the first millennium, but it wasn't until power was centralized in the Pope until a little after the 13th century that integralism ruled the day. What's key here is a semi-distinction between the church and the state, but the integration of both. What the church does, the state backs up. If the church, like Dr. Valier stated, convicts someone of heresy and they do not repent, change their mind, then the state comes in and imprisons them. So the state doesn't have the power over the church, nor does it direct the church. It backs her up. The Pope has direct oversight of the church and indirect oversight of the state. They work together, sort of as a tag team. The state has a distinct power separate from the church, but adds it to hers. That's why Dr. Valier says integralism opened the door for nationalism and its more intense cousin, the theocratic state. Now that we've got a definition of integralism, how might Dr. Valier describe Christian nationalism, its intellectual inferior?
I mean, most Catholic theologians are pretty nigh universally very opposed to integralism. But they tend to not mind a certain degree of religious establishment. So the idea, for instance, is clear, even in the most liberal Catholic documents, that while we shouldn't have a state that kind of imposes Catholicism, societies do have a duty to the true religion, and that involves, hopefully, some degree of recognition of the truth of the Catholic faith. Now, some of them are very left-wing economically, some are more market-friendly. But in general, they seem to think certain soft forms of establishment and principle are okay. And so, I mean, in this country, we consider any form of religious establishment shocking. But these are folks, you know, they're from Quebec or Ireland or Spain or Italy, where there's a lot more establishment, and they just think it's pretty innocuous. So some of your listeners may think, oh, wow, it's Catholic Church, so establishmentarian. Well, I mean, traditionally, yes. But this is true of many Protestant denominations. I mean, it's basically all the 13 colonies had Christian established Protestant churches. So, yeah, so in that respect, I see American Christian nationalism as sort of like trying to push back in that kind of general direction. But in the Catholic Church, there's not been the kind of hostility to establishment of any kind that you sometimes see in Protestantism. There's really no equivalent to, say, the Baptists, you know, against state establishment. So,
the integralists opened the door, and the nationalists kicked it open and established it. Interestingly, the Catholics have less an animosity to any kind of religious establishment, even though they've never formally established one. The Protestants, however, kicked against the goads, if you will. This is especially true for the Baptists because of the autonomous nature of their churches, hence Southern Baptist Convention, not denomination. There are quasi-formal links between these churches, but they're at base autonomous churches. 9 of the original 13 American colonies had established churches, but none were uniform in how they set them up. There were Anglicans, Episcopalians, Congregationalists, and others comprised those original 9. Integralists didn't establish churches because the state came around and enforced what the church already did. So, Modern-day nationalists find some of the roots in the American establishmentarians who walked through the door the integralists opened. We see how one led to the other, but what are some of their core differences? Here's Dr. Valier.
Yeah, well, where that you don't have the Pope as head of the church, right?
Correct.
So the important thing about integralism and the reason that many of the American integralists have had a conflicted relationship with national conservatism is that integralism is not a nationalist doctrine.
Okay.
The Pope is an international ruler of Catholic states in many respects. So, for instance, Adrian Vermeule, the most prominent American integralist, says he's not a nationalist. Nationalism is a good second best, but he's even, I think, said somewhat tongue-in-cheek that, you know, we should have a hemispheric empire of Our Lady of Guadalupe in North and South America and free more or less open immigration in the U.S. for Roman Catholics. So, you know, this is not a nationalist movement, but it sees Christian nationalism as a potentially helpful bulwark in getting to where they want to go. It's also the case that it's not nationalist in the sense that there are conditions under which popes can depose Christian kings. In particular, if the king becomes a convicted heretic, it is part of integralism that the church can release those under him, under the heretical king, from their vows of obedience. This is one reason there was such a fight over a lot of integralism gets articulated when James I starts to force people to swear, the English to swear fealty to him over the Pope. And some of the great counter-reformation theologians like Francisco Suarez criticized the allegiance in detail in the process to defend integralism. So it's not nationalist in those two respects. It's international in focus. And the Pope can depose kings, can depose ruling nations.
It's succinct. Integralism is international, while Christian nationalism is national. Seems obvious, right? In the integralist system, the church doesn't tell the state what to do, neither the state tell the church what to do. Individual magistrates, sort of a fancy word for ruler, have authority over their nation or state, but the Pope can hire and fire at will, to be a little anachronistic. Christian nationalism focuses on a group of people who share the same cultural proclivities, traditions, and laws. It is by nature not focused internationally. It is isolationist, insular, worried about itself and keeping others out. By nature, Catholic integralism is not nationalist. There is no establishment principle because of its international scope. That's one, if not the core, difference between the two political methodologies. So what are the others? Dr. Valier again.
Protestantism is a different story.
Yeah.
If you decide, if you're baptized and you leave the church, there is a weaker grounds, not no grounds, to force you to stay. And if you're going to ban heresy, then you've got to decide how widely you're going to do it.
Yep.
So one good question for any Christian nationalist is what happens to Catholics?
Yep. that's what everybody's been asking them. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, it's Christian nationalism, one of its dangers is breaking up the 50s to 80s coalition of Jews, Protestants, and Catholics, theological conservatives, that was able to be politically effective in advancing socially conservative ends. There's a way in which Christian nationalism is just tremendously factionalizing, which is really pointless. So yeah, you've just got to ask, okay, well, how do these folks fare? And if you look at the Alan Oler, Doug Wilson's interview, there's like, oh, they go one direction when asked about things in general and then go in another direction when they're asked about Jews specifically.
Yep.
And it's just precisely the internal tension that I saw. So they have to care about insiders and outsiders, right? Like they need some way to mark the distinction. And if they're primarily focused on coercing insiders to be better members, then I think that's wrong, but we can have more of a discussion. The difficulty is freedom of conscience. Now, the issue that comes up here is the implicit assumption that a heretic can't be non-culpably confused. Thought is that, well, if someone's a heretic, there has to be something corrupt in their judgment. And in that case, if they're culpable for their heresy, then punishment seems appropriate. All right. At the same time, you could get oppressive, a lot of oppressive Calvinism, for instance, on the European continent, but you get such an anti-authoritarian form of it in Scotland and England and the United States.
Yep.
That it's just really hard to see why you would even be involved in coercing the baptized unless the heresy were danger to public order itself. Right. And unless the other religion was. But I mean, so in any case, I just they're Protestant national, they're gonna have to have an insider outsider distinction. And then you look at what they want to do to insiders, okay, and then you look at what they do want to do to outsiders. The most coherent position is that you leave outsiders alone and you coerce the insiders. That's the Catholic integralist position.
Yep.
Not entirely, but that it works that way. But for me, I don't think the Christian nationalists have grounds to impose anything that they don't think can be established by natural reason. Mm-hmm. The idea of forcing unbaptized Jews to go to church, I mean, I just don't. I'm like 100% sure Doug Wilson would want nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
Right. He's not going to box Jews into mass, like, well, not even mass for him, but like, you know, what's going on 17th century.
But his thing is like no public office for a lot of nationalists. There's no public office, no public function whatsoever. Maybe they have a private life, but there's no public life for those who are outside the church.
Yeah. So you'd have a test for office at the federal level, like you did at the state level for a century or more. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the difficulty then is you've got a democracy and you've got to ask, okay, if people have equal political rights, what does that mean? Does it mean that anyone can run for office? Well, we already think there's some people who can't run for office, like non-citizens or like Nazis. You know, we don't really think they could run. I guess we let them run. But, but I do think there's going to be a question about how persons can be made in the image of God, and yet some of them have right to shape their political institutions and others do not. Mm-hmm. So then if they say, oh, well, look, you know, Jews can vote. I mean, that's fine. They just can't hold high office. No, that starts to look like attention to me, right? Like you have political freedom because you need to be able to shape your institutions so that they better reflect your interests or protect your interests. But if you want to elect someone from your community that you think is effective at protecting your interests, nope, can't do that. So why? I mean, you ultimately have to say, well, because Christianity is true and Judaism is false.
Yep.
But if you think that's the basis for coercion, just whether who's correct and who's incorrect, that's going to justify far more coercion than people usually want to use.
It's such an important point. It's worth restating it. Integralism is inclusive, while nationalism is exclusive. By the very fact that the Pope is the international figurehead of Catholicism, they cannot be exclusive. So membership is down to baptism. You have that, you're in. The very nature of Christian nationalism denies the same. For one, you'd have too much infighting amidst and amongst nationalists on the nature of baptismal claims. Who was it done by? What denomination? What does it mean? Etc. Etc. You heard last episode from both Stephen Wolfe, Doug Wilson, and Joel Webbin that Christian nationalism holds to cultural differences. The fear of immigration, the expulsion of immigrants already here, and the preserving of our shared heritage, whatever that means, makes nationalism the polar opposite of integralism. It's why when Doug Wilson or any other nationalist proponent says, everyone will enjoy equal rights in our coming political project, you must push them. If that's the case, it's by nature not nationalist. If it isn't, it's coercive. So going back to the reformers, those who grew up in an integralist system of sorts, how did they respond to it? So many Christian nationalists go back to the 16th century Geneva, or something similar to it, as the example of what they're hoping to build in the 21st century or beyond. But is that what it is?
I mean, it's important to remember at this time and really until the early 20th century that the Pope had temporal domains of which he was sovereign, the Papal States in Italy, in central Italy. And various times the Pope would have his own army, his own troops, or at least he could easily raise an army, say through the Holy Roman Emperor or something like that. The Spanish crown eventually when it's it's complicated. Part of the time is part of the Holy Roman Empire. But so the Spanish crown, the French crown, so on, could raise armies in many cases. They're also seen as rulers that could have, you know, dramatic impact on people's day-to-day lives, including kings. So for instance, the Pope might not just excommunicate a king, but might impose interdict on the entire nation. An interdict is basically a denial of all but the most important sacraments to the average Christian, like being able to receive the Eucharist. So it's essentially spiritually starving a people in order to control a king. I mean, I just have to say, as a Christian, it's like supremely unjust and wicked thing to do.
Yeah.
But these are powers that the new kings want to avoid. Many kings before didn't like it, but the early modern monarchs were powerful enough to tell the Pope to go away. It doesn't mean the Pope couldn't create instability or that they hadn't created instability. So, for instance, like, I think one of Henry VIII's most wicked acts was the seizure of the monasteries. So it's not like the Pope was the oppressor or something like that. I mean, in many cases, if the Pope had more authority to rein in these nationalist leaders, it would have been better for the people. So Protestantism is trying to recover what they regard as an earlier relationship between church and state, where the emperor is pretty involved in church life in terms of governing it. In the manner of the early Byzantine emperors. So for instance, like Constantine or Justinian. So it's not like the Protestants make this up, but they revive it in the West.
Okay.
After centuries of it being opposed, in part based on the Bible, particularly the Old Testament monarchs. So if you think about the relationship between Moses and Aaron, it's not like Aaron could depose Moses.
No.
Right. I mean, that would be, you know, preposterous.
Yeah, Miriam tries to, but that doesn't go very well.
Yeah, yeah. So right. I mean, you know, as soon as Moses leaves Aaron alone, it's golden calf. So so I think that's one of the things the reformers are doing. Because I don't want to do the Catholic or even Orthodox thing of saying, oh, look, Protestants made everything up, you know.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that's true. But they are trying to revive a model that was much more common in the Eastern Empire than in the Latin Christendom.
The Protestant reformers were looking for something less oppressive as opposed to more. They were reared under some of these systems, starved spiritually and starved physically. Nationalist leaders were the oppressors, and the Protestants, as well as Catholics, were the oppressed. A magistrate could go rogue and force the Pope to act. So the Protestants reached back into history and pulled out a former way of the church interacting with the state, to relieve pressure from the state. They were not attempting to create a theocratic state. They were attempting to get out from under one. So, what did the reformers build? Dr. Valier explains their analog to the integralist system.
Well, I mean, the Anabaptists are going to, reject all kinds, of course, of authority.
Uh-huh.
Not every kind. But, they're reacting directly to integralist type arrangements, but also to Protestant confessional state. So they, you know, their sympathies for pacifism is just going to be a very different outlook. For instance, they may even question whether God has established the state or whether it's a demonic force in some cases. The sort of magisterial reformers, and many times they went back to basically the model that tended to prevail in Eastern Orthodox countries that we call Cesaropapism. In France, which was Catholic, the idea of that the king could, say, appoint his own bishops was called Gallicanism. And it didn't make him ahead of the Pope, but it was a little bit more of a state-centered view of church authority. And then in England, it was called Erastianism. And so the doctrine here was that God had made the king the supreme governor of both the earthly life and the supreme governor of the church. Now, the king did not administer the sacraments, but the priesthood was under his authority as supreme governor. And there are figures, and really important and brilliant figures, say like Richard Hooker, who's a big influence on Locke, who in turn was a big influence on Jefferson, who said, you know, look, I mean, the Old Testament kings had this ecclesiastical authority, and we should expect that to continue. And that was their argument against the integralists of that day, of their day, which was that the king actually did have some ecclesiastical authority. The integralists are basically trying to laicize kings. deprive them of any sacramental or ecclesiastical function. Huh. And the Protestants are trying to maintain that in part to reduce the political power of the Catholic Church. And because they have a new and different understanding of what the church is, it's much more common among Protestants to think of the church as a kind of purely voluntary association, in part because of the theology of baptism. In Catholicism, in an integralist regime, being baptized as an infant suffices for one to be under the church's authority and the authority of a church-authorized state. So the doctrine of infant baptism, in particular the details about how it makes one a member of the church, enable a great deal of anti-liberal coercion and religious coercion that actually I think Protestants have a really hard time sustaining. I just don't, for instance, I mean, in Calvinist forms of quote-unquote integralism, you know, yeah, you have baptism of infants, but you don't have, I mean, like there has to be some kind of like voluntary movement of the will as a near adult or something like that for one to come under the church's authority in those cases. So while once you join the church, it might be pretty authoritarian, if you don't, the doctrine of freedom of conscience here is so strong that I think Christian nationalism is kind of an unstable, philosophically unstable position. I mean, I think integralism is mostly coherent with itself to an extent to which Christian nationalism is not, because Protestant doctrines of baptism and freedom of conscience. So you can say within the Christian community, you can enforce biblical law and, oh, this is a Christian nation. And so we, but there, it always has to be that somehow that relationship of entry into the church's polity is more voluntary than in Catholicism.
Whereas for Catholic integralists, membership into the church and the state was through your baptism, for the Protestant Reformed, this was voluntary. Baptism was not seen as your citizenship requirement because of how the state rallied behind the church's decisions, but your voluntary association with a certain church was crucial for the freedom of conscience Dr. Vallier described. Note how different that sounds from the modern-day Christian nationalist project, where empower is mentioned far more than freedom. Sure, you could say there's freedom for the Christian, but certainly not for the citizen. In many ways, the modern Christian nationalist is trying to borrow both from the integralist and early Reformed projects. But you can't have it both ways. For the integralist, whoever is baptized is part of the church and state, regardless of your cultural background or tradition, because it's an inherently international system. For the nationalist, it's cultural assimilation into a particular definition of the Christian tradition. With the differences in front of us, and the shaky and intellectually dishonest grounds of Christian nationalism, let's talk to another scholar on the founders and what tradition they pulled from. Both integralism and nationalism were on offer, but what did they go with?
Great. Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here. My name is Chirom Kapolsky, and I'm a research fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University. And I've just written a book entitled American Heretics, Religious Adversaries of Liberal Order, which will be published by Yale University Press.
Jerome Kapolsky's interests intersect at America's founding, liberal democracy, and Christian Reconstructionism. His first book, American Heretics, is a perfect work for this section of the series. Kapolsky looks seriously at the constitutional republic drafted by the founders and the various ways religious sects have sought to undermine it, replace it, battle it, or reject it. Sound familiar? I began by asking Dr. Kapolsky about the original intent of the founding fathers. What did they set out to establish? How influenced were they by the Christian religion? Did they self-consciously set up a secular state without reference to religious or do they leave the door open for interpretation? Let's continue with Jerome Kapolsky.
So what you've probably been discussing throughout these other conversations is the question of what was the founder's intent in the United, as far as the relationship of religion and politics, church and state in the United States. It's clear that the founders did not attempt to create a theocracy, did not create to recreate Calvin's Geneva or Puritan New England, nor did they set out to create a Catholic state. But what was the relationship? How did they understand what role religion would play in the new republic? And the Christian nationalist story, or one of the Christian nationalist stories, is that the founders were pious Christians, that they did not intend to set up a Christian state where there was an established church, such as the one that pertained in England and Britain. But they didn't attempt to separate religion from politics.
Entirely. I see. Yep.
So that they assumed what some might call a Christian nation, that the population was Christian, that the state would have some role, or the states would have some role in inculcating Christian morality that would then sort of shape those citizens and shape the political institutions. So that's like one story that we hear. Another story, the opposite story, is that the founders were men of the Enlightenment. They were worried about the relationship of religion and politics. They wanted to sort of separate the church and from the state so much as possible, and that they instituted a regime of separation of church and state, which would really come to fruition in the 1950s. So they imagined a secular republic rather than a Christian one.
One of the biggest objections to the original intent by the founders is, but didn't states have established churches? If the federal government didn't establish a certain church or impose one on the people, why did the states continue from where England left off? If you've followed online discourse and possibly far-right political conversations, you've come up against these objections. Maybe you have them yourself. It's a fair question, because the states did have established churches, or at least they allowed them. It's a thorny issue if you're not aware of why the states had them, how it differed from the Church of England, and why those established churches eventually left the state. Not to mention, there are odds with the disestablishment principle of the federal government. But I'll let Jerome fill you in on more.
Yeah, so if we go back to the colonial period, right before the Revolutionary War, the colonies from sort of in the South, from Virginia, Maryland down south, so Virginia, Maryland, the Carolinas, Georgia, they all had establishments, and the establishments were the Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
New England, Massachusetts, Connecticut, also had establishments. They were the standing order, the Congregationalist establishment.
Mm-hmm.
The Church of England was also established in four counties in New York, but everything else was kind of a free-for-all. Right. So you know, the most radical of the states was Rhode Island, which was founded by Roger Williams as kind of asylum for religious freedom. But there was, you know, many different churches and sects in places like Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, what have you. And during the Revolutionary War, it really the Church of England collapsed. Right. You couldn't. Right. There wasn't the Church of England no longer had standing in those places where it was established. In fact, one of the things that happens, during the Revolutionary War and afterwards is the rebranding of the Church of England as the Protestant Episcopal Church of America. Right. You can't have a church. You're not going to have a Church of England in the United States of America. Right? So there was a kind of a rebranding that went on, and those establishments, which were, I should also say, kind of weak to begin with in the South. They complained that they lacked the fundamental thing that an established church should have, which was a bishop. The Church of England never saw fit to settle a bishop in the American colonies. They were all under the authority of the Bishop of London. So those establishments fade away. You still have the lingering Congregationalist establishments in New England, but over by the 1820s, 1830s, they collapse as well, right? So really the overarching sort of theological political energy is towards disestablishment or non-establishment. At the same time, there's this, you know, energy towards creating new churches, right? So the Second Great Awakening happens, the influx of people into the Methodist Church, which of course breaks away from the Church of England. During the war, there's the growth of the Baptists. there are the growth of new, what we would call new religious movements, like the Mormons. All of this is happening, and it's happening because of this new regime of non-establishment periodism, I might say. The fact that there was no federal established religion, the fact that the states were loosening their establishments, even as they would keep certain that there might be certain, you know, rules about Sabbath rules, right? There might be rules about they're in, you know, prayer in schools and Bible reading in public schools become part of this new settlement. But you don't, but the states no longer say in order to be a full citizen of Virginia, you need to be an Episcopalian.
The question to ask is, why were the states so far behind the federal government? Why did it take between 40 to 50 years for the established church to die off? Why would the states continue what immigrants from England left? Most Christian nationalist pundits point to the stretch of time from the nation's founding to the disestablishment of the state churches, which weren't really, and the pressure from secular enlightenment and the remnants of the French Revolution as a fuel behind the fiery breakup between state and church. But it's not that simple. This is Jerome's wheelhouse. Let's hear from him.
Yeah, and you know, we can go back and you can look at, you know, already in Virginia, you know, under, you know, with Madison, you know, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson's idea of religious liberty, the idea that the state doesn't tell you what church you should belong to, and the state doesn't assess, doesn't tax you and take your taxes and give it to any particular church or minister or what have you. Mm-hmm. And this becomes part of the kind of the new spirit of the nation, right? And it's not, again, it's not necessarily secular. It's not necessarily anti-religious. It is anti-establishment, and it allows for a kind of free market and essentially endorses a free market of religion. Now, one of the things I'll say is that the national conservatives, the post-liberals, the Christian nationalists, don't, when it comes down to it, probably don't like this idea of a free market of religion, because they all want to have a monopoly, mm-hmm. right? They think that they belong to the true religion. They think that true religion is the only religion that the state should endorse. But the history of the United States has been a history of a kind of free market of religion, for, you know, for good or for bad. And the energy, the religious energies that were unleashed by that, whether they're channeled into the direction of sort of these new denominations that were emerging, or the denominations splitting from denominations, or new religious movements and traditions that are emerging, or whether or not they allow for immigrants to come to the United States, plant and transform their own traditions here, right? That is central to the American story. That's central to the history of religion in America. And that is something that I think the discourse is often, and you tell me what, you know, what you've heard in these conversations, mm-hmm. The Christian nationalists will essentially say it is, you know, Christianity versus kind of the secularists.
Yeah.
But in a way, I think it's actually people who think that they have, you know, that their religion ought to be the dominant religion or be the monopoly religion, versus people who want to, you know, go on, you know, either live their own religious lives or go on their own religious journeys, or sure, not participate at all. But it's not just sort of religion versus secular.
What Jerome says here is key. The disestablishment of religion on the federal and state levels wasn't driven by secularism or the woke encroach. It was driven by an open market principle of religious freedom, the ability to join the kind of church that you want to. This was unheard of throughout world history up to this point. It was the brilliance of the founders to allow an open competition among the religious faiths. Go anywhere with an established church that's been on the ground for hundreds of years, and what might you find? A dead church. A church that's been tied to the state will be sucked to drive its life in favor of a nationalist agenda. Christian nationalism, I'm talking to you. An open market strengthens religious alternatives, as I'm sure any capitalist loves saying about the open market of business. But this all falls away if you're certain you're right and everyone's wrong. that you should have the monopoly and everyone fall in line with you. The problem? If you put 1,000 Presbyterians in a room, I can use this example because I'm one, you'll get 1,000 different interpretations of various biblical passages and confessional statements. Will there be similarities? Of course, but no one will be perfectly aligned. You who are looking for a monopoly on religion, good luck agreeing with your Christian nationalist neighbor a year from now. Speaking about Christian nationalism, were there Christian nationalists at the founding? What do they think about this newly established constitutional republic? What strands of Christian nationalism have come to prominence over the past 200 years? And how did the various strands interact with the Constitution? Here's Jerome again.
Okay, so let me say a couple things about the founding and then talk about a group that I think in a way is a good precursor. So if we look at the federal Constitution, which is drafted in 1787, the federal government is not given any jurisdiction over matters of religion, right? We see this in a number of places. First, in Article 6, Section 3 of the Constitution, where there's no religious test for federal office.
Yep.
We see this in the religion clauses of the First Amendment. We see this also in the fact that there's no acknowledgement of God in the Constitution, right? In the Declaration of Independence, there are four references to God or providence or deity in the Declaration of Independence, but that's not there in the federal Constitution. And, you know, most scholars see this as a concession to the realities of religious pluralism on the ground, right? They did not want to have an established church like there was in Great Britain. B, if there was to be some kind of a strong relationship of the federal government to Christianity, which Christianity would it be, right? Would it be the new Episcopal Church? Would it be the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, the Baptists, right? So there was too much religious diversity even at that time. And also the states had retained some jurisdiction of the questions of religion. There was still some lingering establishments. There were certainly laws pertaining to religion in a number of the states. So it seemed like the best way of getting a federal constitution, getting that sort of over the goal line, so to speak, was to sort of remain neutral as possible on that fundamental issue. Now, there was some quibbling, particularly on Article 6, Section 3, like the idea that, well, if you don't have a religious test for office, you can have non-Trinitarians, non-Protestants, non-Christians becoming federal officers.
Yep.
There was some quibbling about the fact that there was no acknowledgement of the deity in the Constitution, but the document is ratified and it kind of goes forward. Now, there was a group of Presbyterians who had descended from a Scottish group of Presbyterians that came to be known as the Reformed Presbyterians or the Covenanters. Mm-hmm. And in the early Republic, one of the ways in which they distinguished themselves from other Presbyterian and Christian denominations in the new United States was through what they called their testimony of political dissent. Mm-hmm. They looked at the Constitution, the federal Constitution, and they rejected the church-state settlement.
Yep.
Right? So essentially, they did not believe that the federal government could be neutral with regard to religion. The government was neutral, but was positively infidel because of this failure to acknowledge God, in particular on Christ as ruler of nations. The no religious test meant that a magistrate could be a pagan or a Jew or a Muslim or a Catholic. The freedom of religion, which was stipulated in the First Amendment, meant the freedom of infidelity, the freedom of false religion. So the Covenanters decided that they would not participate in the federal government and in fact with the state governments as well. They saw this as a kind of conscientious objection to what they saw as an infidel government, and they would not participate, which they wouldn't obviously stand for office, they wouldn't vote, they wouldn't serve on juries, they would try to avoid the militia, they would pay their taxes, but they felt, you know, they really had no other choice but to pay their taxes, but they would not participate until such a time that the nation repented and acknowledge God and Christ and in the Constitution, right? That was their testimony of political dissent. The classic statement of this was a pamphlet published by a minister named Samuel B. Wiley called Two Sons of Oil. And this became kind of their mark of distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a large part of their history, you know, for the first, you know, decades into the 19th century, their witness was just to not participate, right? They would preach against the infidel constitution. They would sometimes publish their sermons. These would be, you know, obviously rather controversial, but they did not think that they could do anything politically to change it because, you know, they acknowledged the fact that there was an amendment process within the Constitution, but in order to work towards that, they would actually have to vote for representatives, which meant that they would have to identify with the government, which meant that they would break it.
Yep.
So essentially, they would hope other people, other Americans, would come to their senses and fix it.
Yep.
So that was their kind of way of being. That was part of their, you know, religious witness up until the Civil War. Now, I should mention one more thing about their critique of the Constitution. They also felt it was fundamentally sinful because they saw it as a pro-slavery document, a pro-slavery instrument. Hmm. They saw slavery was the federal Constitution allowed for the continuation of the institution of slavery, and the Reformed Presbyterians believed that slavery, American slavery, was sinful. So they were early abolitionists on this. So comes to the Civil War. The Reformed Presbyterians, among other Protestants in the North and in the South, saw the Civil War as divine punishment for the nation's sins. And in particular, the Reformed Presbyterians saw the nation's sin as the sin of this sort of infidel founding. The very foundations of the nation had betrayed the relationship with God, and this, the Civil War, was the comeuppance, so to speak. So during the Civil War, they joined forces with other Protestant groups to put forward an amendment, a Christian amendment, a religious amendment, which would essentially rewrite the preamble of the Constitution to acknowledge God, Christ as ruler of nations, and the Bible as the source of law. Right? And this would be a form of repentance and in response to the horrors of the Civil War. And in fact, they were even able to have an audience with President Lincoln to make this proposal.
Hmm.
And they lobbied Congress so that the Constitution would be altered in this fashion. I should also mention at this point that the Southerners, one of the Confederate states, came together to draft their new Constitution. They did acknowledge God in its preamble, but they also acknowledged the institution of slavery and the ownership of human beings. So both there were Christians on both sides who looked at the Constitution and saw the failure to acknowledge God as a flaw that needed to be corrected, and in fact the flaw that had created a polity, that created a society that had led to the conflagration of the Civil War. So I mentioned this group after the Civil War in the 1870s. They continued this project of pushing for a religious amendment. So there was a huge petition campaign that was launched throughout the United States that was headed by the vanguard were the Reformed Presbyterians, who, remember, aren't even voting.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this was a kind of political participation that they believed that they could have leading this religious amendment movement, but also bringing into this movement other conservative Protestant groups who now were arguing not for the need of this amendment as a form of repentance, but as a way to protect America and America's fundamentally Christian character and institutions from Catholics, Jews, secularists, Mormons, and so on. So it becomes a conservative nativist movement in the 1870s.
Hmm.
So I think that you can, if you go back and you actually read some of the speeches that were given at their conferences in the 1870s, you can hear some of the language that we hear in today's national conservatives, that the nation is being threatened. It's being threatened by people who share its fundamental values, that the state is no longer protecting and representing Christianity, and therefore something needs to be done on a structural level, on a constitutional level, in order to secure and perpetuate those ideas, those institutions, and those values.
Guess you can't teach an old dog new tricks, at least not with the nationalist contingent. They keep trying the same thing over and over and over again. You'd think they learn. Painting with a broad brush, there's three basic groups within Christian nationalist ranks, and you can break them down further. We'll go with three. Those who abstain from anything political at all, the Covenanters. Those who want to restore the Constitution to its supposed Christian roots, the Restorationists. And those who want to destroy the current order and establish a new one, the Reconstructionists. We will dive deeper into these three groups in the next episode, but you can basically plug in whatever Christian nationalist group into one of these three categories. The first group, you've got the Christians who live in communes, free from political filth, or the Covenanters. The second group, you've got the more majority of the 70s and 80s who are convinced we've lost our path and need to get back on it. The third group are the Bonsons, Rushtunis, and Norse. And to learn more about them, you'll have to tune in to our next episode. Suffice it to say, what you're seeing today is no different than what's happened historically. It's just as terrifying. It's just not new. Historical grounding will help remind you we've been here before. My last bit with Jerome before we return to Dr. Valier will serve as a sneak peek into that third group, the Reconstructionists. Think of them as Doug Wilson's political and theological granddaddies. Who were they, and what did they try to do? I'll give you a peek behind the curtain, but you gotta wait a little bit for the full episode.
What I do in American Heretics is consider a series of religious thinkers from the time of the American Revolution until today that would, in a sense, agree with the secular story that America, that the United States of America, was not founded to be a Christian nation. But they would say that this was the great failing of the founders. In other words, the founders did not adequately ground this new polity on revealed truth. And therefore, the problems that the United States has faced have in a fundamental way could find their origin in this failure, this original failure, this original sin, so to speak. And so I trace a history beginning with Church of England loyalists during the time of the American Revolution up through contemporary post-liberals and national conservatives who share this critique that the United States was not adequately founded, although their understanding of the failure is often quite different. Their understanding of what a truly Christian state, of what the right sort of relationship of religious institutions and religious authority to political institutions and political authority may be very different, right? The loyalists of the Church of England had a very different idea of what that should look like than, say, contemporary post-liberal Catholics. But what I think what this book does is it really provides us with a different perspective on the entire question of both the nature of the founding, the nature of the relationship between political authority and religious authority, and how that played out in the history of the United States.
So there was an influence from the Christian tradition, but it's because of that tradition that the founders founded a nation that was open to all, that they might enjoy the benefits available to them. Again, this was not uniformly applied to all peoples, and that was a failure of the founders' project and the founders themselves, but the Christian tradition demands it. These groups have always existed. They've tried the same tactics, and they've always failed. So we can learn from their attempts throughout American history and apply the same principles Jerome has lined out in this episode and his book American Heretics. Let's go back to Dr. Valier for some help on how exactly the Christian tradition both prepared and pressured the American Republic to establish a democracy, not a religion?
This is a pretty complicated question. So to some extent, the internationalism and the structure of the state's authority are somewhat orthogonal, right? So you could be a monarchist and internationalist, you could be a Democrat or internationalist or whatever. So just setting aside the internationalist thing, a lot of the integralists have played footsie or been openly monarchist. Okay. But there's no necessity there at all. So for instance, both Francisco Suarez and Cardinal Bellarmine, who were the two great integralist minds of the Counter-Reformation and two great minds of integralism, period. Suarez thought the first form of government was democracy. He thought a political authority had ultimately to choose a ruler had to come from the people because people were naturally equals. Bellarmine thought that God gave political authority to the people as a whole because God is impartial. And he's not going to give more political power to one person over another person. And I think those commitments push in the direction of democracy. And so I think you could have a constitutionally limited democracy where, say, the church would be able to direct the legislature to impose certain kinds of enforcement of natural law. And, you know, they could veto, would have to have some kind of blessing from them for prime minister, much like you do with the, as a formality with the British monarch.
Yep, totally. Yep.
Because ultimately, Christianity's doctrine of equality of persons, you really have to go to divine right of kings. But then I think there's just a whole bunch of problems that actually came up, which is like, okay, so as you have a succession crisis, who is God appointed to win? Okay, well, we've been there and had many European civil wars over succession crises, mm-hmm. especially before the, you know, a lot of the states consolidated. So, you know, who has the authority of God? Moreover, what are they authorized to do? God didn't seem to be very specific about that. And so we don't know who God's appointed or what powers God's given them. There are ways to try to work through those problems. But if you think persons have equal dignity, then they could start to answer those questions. Oh, who should rule? Oh, who the majority chooses? What are their powers? Well, we put those in the Constitution. So I think that Christian doctrine, the dignity of the person and the equality of persons before God, really lays the foundations for liberal democracy in a really important way. And it's really hard for Protestants to escape it in particular. Protestantism is so deeply rooted in the equality of persons.
Yep.
This is why so many of the colonies were democracies, right? I mean, or at least to some extent democratic. I mean, this, you know, these folks, if they're talking about monarchy, so they would have centralized Massachusetts Bay Colony. Like the Massachusetts Bay Colony should have had a king. That's not what they thought their congregational ecclesiology was.
No.
Right? So I would be very interested to see, say, maybe Doug Wilson saying, the American Calvinist or Presbyterian establishments were wrong. They're deeply misguided.
And we understand now that we say that. You're right. He'd have to say that. Else, you know, what else is he going to prop up?
You just got to hold these people's feet to the fire about their theology. And then I think things are going to fall apart. And again, Catholics have much better grounds with positions like this, like much, much better. But yeah, Protestantism, I mean, it really does sort of lead in a certain way to a constitutionally limited democracy in a way that it is consistent with its own theological principles. Now, you know, you could still have like, oh, God exists and here are the Ten Commandments or whatever, but like, that's pretty anemic. It didn't really seem to do much good. Even the Catholic establishments, I mean, you know, they all died in effect in Western Europe. So it's not clear in any case. This is, again, why I see Christian nationalism as kind of like fundamentally unserious intellectually. I call it the Walmart integralism.
I like
You know, the ones at the boutique, right? Not many people buy it, but it's very sophisticated. And the other's bargain basement. Everyone can get on board, but it isn't much. It isn't substantive. It's kind of a knockoff as well. So there are all these interesting early modern, you know, doctrine. There was so much Christian thought, especially in the Calvinist tradition about democracy.
Yep.
I mean, you know, you've got a lot of these kind of center-right followers of Abraham Kuyper, mm-hmm. like Jordan Baller, who were just like, yeah, these guys are theologically completely off base. And if you look at the reviews from a lot of the Reformed of, say, the Stephen Wolfe book, In Defense of Christian Nationalism, they just panned it as being theologically unserious from a Reformed perspective. So this is what I have found to be useful in these, is to have a deeper understanding of the theology and then the political theology, and to see if the political theology fits the rest of the theology. Calvinism is just so congregationalist in terms of the rule by elders. And it was one of the very important ways they contrasted themselves with Catholics very early on, that to be a Calvinist monarchist requires some explanation, I think.
Protestantism and the Christian scriptures necessitate a democratic republic. Why? Because of the inherent equality of all people, the image of God reflected in each and every individual, whether Christian or non-Christian. A nationalist paradigm and an integralist buck against this in different ways. The nationalist system does not respect the equality of persons that Protestantism upholds. If all people are equal, and the image of God transcends all cultural, political, and economic backgrounds, what right does a government have to preserve a common heritage among people group? The integralist system effectively denies the freedom of conscience because belonging to the church and state is no longer a voluntary association, but one imposed upon you. Hopefully by now, you can tell just how different America's founding is from that of a nationalist or integralist system. Let's drill down even further and listen to Dr. Valier as he describes the political and theological problems with nationalism as a political paradigm.
So again, I'm just trying to establish, like, this Christian nationalism stuff, I mean, whatever you think about it, it does have historical precedent. The problem is that the fundamental structure of relationships among human persons and institutions is so different than it was in those societies, that what Christian nationalism would mean for our lives today would be very different than what it meant before. One big issue is that our societies are staggeringly larger.
True.
Geographically and in terms of population. If you've got a little tiny city state that's oppressive, you can leave. And even if you can't travel very far, but and even though people didn't really do that, now that most people are literate, and education is sort of highly prized, the ability to kind of tamp down on disagreements, which just come to humans naturally, is far more limited. It's also the case that we have democracies. And so if the prime minister converts to a religion, no one thinks that they should, right? Like, a lot of countries are Christianized because the king converted and then told his soldiers to get baptized. And people just don't work that way anymore. I mean, we could still be sheep here and there, but there's so many layers and complicated institutions. There aren't these simple, more simple legal arrangements. There's too many centers of power, different institutions doing different kinds of things. And that just leads to the fostering of disagreement. I mean, democracy itself says, hey, let's disagree. Let's have a disagreement and try to figure out which way we ought to go. It just invites people to disagree. And so the idea of Christian nationalism today would have to be pretty oppressive because of how many people would disagree. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I think it's of interest right now, is that it is in its stronger forms proposing things that would have to be pretty coercive, pretty destructive of the dignity of the person. Not to say they weren't back in their time, but you can have a country where everyone thinks this is how we've always done things. This is just who we are. And there's some Christian nationalists who say that, but they're plainly aware that there's a very, very large portion of the population that's secular progressive, right? And so you have to sort of think in terms of, say, majority Catholic or majority Protestant countries and how they treated very large Catholic or respective Protestant minorities, which is in many cases either toleration or persecution. And the persecutions usually backfired because there's just too many people and they were too convicted to just go along with it. Sometimes it worked, but it worked best in Spain because Protestants weren't really allowed in the first place. Once you got large Protestant populations, destroying them was just a bloodbath, incredibly destructive. And so I think with the modern day Christian nationalists, if you push them, what really take to homogenize the population, they're not going to go to where the integralists even go. And the integralists don't even say that you can use religious coercion against the unbaptized. It's only for the baptized.
Interesting.
And so you have to respect the religious liberty of unbaptized Jews and Muslims and so on. Although you don't have to respect their practices if they violate natural laws. You can ban Muslim polygamy, for instance. So, I mean, I just don't think that Christian nationalism is going to be able to stand in a coherent way that it could guide policy beyond whatever the more majority has proposed, or whatever laws were on the books in the 1950s in some states. You know, it's mostly saber rattling, but there's not what I see any really deep theological attempt to say, okay, here's how we have a Protestant society given the level of pluralism there is in the United States.
Yep.
What do we do to the people that dissent? And I just don't think they have any good account. If they say we tolerate them, then it's not so Christian nationalist.
No, it's not.
If we don't tolerate them, it's not, I think, Christian. Yep. You have to hurt people. You really have to hurt people. But at the very least, you have to violate freedom of conscience. If you say, oh, we're not going to violate conscience, then again, it's not that Christian nationalist, because non-Christians will be free. But if you don't have toleration, freedom of conscience, then you're violating scriptures, which is the Christian nationalists take to establish freedom of conscience.
True.
So I just don't think this thing can hold up theologically. I think it's just internally unstable. And the Catholic doctrine is more interesting because it is harder to show there's an internal incoherence. But that's my primary critique of it, is I give three internal arguments that by its own light, it can't work. And that takes me about 100 pages to establish, but I think I could establish the internal incoherence of, you know, Christian nationalism intended. So it's just much easier, particularly once you focus on the doctrines of freedom of conscience, the theology of baptism. It's just really to get it going.
Christian nationalism of bygone ages was in response to problems of an oppressive nature. Regardless of the claims of modern-day proponents, there is nothing like what Christians went through in previous centuries. Sacraments, the Lord's Supper and baptism, being withheld, consciences bound, and religious coercion, usually towards Catholicism, were on tap. This makes reestablishing some sort of nationalistic system different by its very nature. We are nowhere near in the same historical situation as Christians of the past. Also, there's the size of modern-day America, being well over 300 million persons. You can exercise coercive control to a far greater degree when your nation is 100,000 or less, the smaller the better. Plus, as Dr. Valier mentioned, you can leave with a far greater ease the smaller your nation was. But today's nations are orders of magnitude larger than anything in history. It's not politically feasible for these systems to be in place without the resulting extreme coercion of North Korea. If any pluralism is tolerated, it isn't nationalist. But if pluralism isn't tolerated, it isn't Christian. The movement itself is unstable, intellectually vapid, and dishonest, as Dr. Valier goes on to explain.
Yeah, it's the greater Protestant emphasis on freedom of conscience, on the equal dignity of the person, worries about a very centralized church, leading to worries about a very centralized state. And the theology of baptism not licensing coercion on people that were baptized as infants but never were believers as adults. So it's much, much harder to kind of discipline people that are members of the church. They may never have joined if they knew they were going to be disciplined, right? Baptism does not automatically make one subject to legal penalties within the church. The church directs the state to enforce. You know, with Islam, apostasy is still seen in many countries as a capital crime. You leave Islam, you should be. There are many, many, many millions of Muslims in the Arab world that think that's cause for execution. So if you don't have punishment for people who leave, like they just move away or whatever, you think there has to be a strong doctrine of freedom of conscience where people can get things wrong legitimately. You think of Protestantism as something that had to resist certain oppressive Catholic structures.
Yep.
All of these theological features will push against a very seriously coercive Christian state. And that's why I think the Christian nationalists aren't really being very specific in their policy proposals, because there's going to be an immediate question. And the immediate question is, once you get specific, how Christian nationalist is this anyway? Like putting the Ten Commandments in courtrooms, like that's basically nothing.
Yeah.
Like in the grand historical scheme of things, it's basically nothing. The question is, what are you going to, I mean,
yeah.
Right. Here's the question for even like Al Mohler, like more mainline folks. Like, if we have a Christian nationalist regime, what about Jews? What about Jews who openly deny the divinity of Christ? What do you want to do? Why would you do these things and not these things? Why or why not? Right. And if they can give you a principled answer to that, I'll be surprised, because they want religious homogeneity, but they don't want to, they want to leave Jews completely alone. And that raises the question of, well, why not leave others completely alone? like atheists and Muslims. So, you know, that's those are kind of a grab bag of all the different difficulties. But the key is to look at the distinctiveness of Protestant political thought as it derives from Protestant theologies. And then I think it'll become clear that Christian nationalism's intellectually unstable.
Dr. Vellier holds the nationalist's feet over the fire of consistency. If you're a Christian nationalist, you must be coercive. That is the very nature of the nationalist project. But to be a Christian, politically, is to uphold the dignity of all human beings because of the inherent image of God in all people. You can only deny access, barring someone with sinister criminal motives, on the basis of dissimilarity culturally, not on the basis of the dignity of the human being. It's why you must push someone who holds to some form of Christian nationalism to their logical and extreme end. Would someone who leaves the Christian faith be under some sort of civil discipline? Would apostasy be judged by the state? Do Jews or Muslims or Hindus or Buddhists or any number of religious or atheistic traditions enjoy the same legal benefits a Christian does? You cannot say yes if you hold to any form of Christian nationalism. As Dr. Hall laid out, there is a difference between enjoying the fruits of the Christian tradition and Christian political theory and a Christian nationalist system. They are not the same. One gives freedom and the other takes it. So Christian nationalism is not Christian. So what is it?
The underlying unity of these doctrines is that they mostly are revived in the late 20th century as a way to oppose sort of hegemony of liberal democratic order. They especially get going as liberal democracy is spreading. Islam's the first here to move.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time you're getting towards the end of the Cold War in the 80s and the 90s, a lot of these doctrines have been sort of dormant or not as influential, and then they just kind of spring back into action. So Hindu nationalism had been around for, you know, 80, 90 years. But then, by the 2000s, it, you know, was starting to take off.
Yep.
The Chinese Confucian stuff was taken off until Xi started putting it down around 5-6 years ago. Looks like he was going to let a lot of it out. And Sunni Islamic, I mean, that's going to be central because, you know, you're looking at organizations like ISIS and you're saying, okay, what is their theology? Like, what are they thinking? That's the most anti-liberal movement that we have seen outside of the Chinese. And so look, what are the theorists of these groups and what are their best theorists, their most sensible theorists saying on their behalf? And they all arise, I think, because first, the 20th century just killed a ton of religious people. Mm-hmm. And it was the first century with globalized secularizing movements.
Yep.
So they're secularizing in the 19th century, but they weren't everywhere. They really limited to Western Europe. And I think that kind of led people to think the silencing of the great religions, the silencing of their voices, massive martyrdom and oppression in the name of usually socialism of some form, typically Marxism, made us think that like we had entered a new, less religious period. And I think we're just seeing a regression to the spiritual mean of the human race, where people will just expect spiritual values to be expressed in politics as they did for thousands upon thousands of years. And so I wanted to look at the global revival of these doctrines, Catholic integralism being one of the least influential. Hindu nationalism I couldn't quite ride on because there's enough like doctrines of toleration and democracy in historic Hinduism that it's harder to Hinduism is maybe the religion where it's kind of hardest to get the really nasty coercive stuff. So I didn't end up writing about it. I could have written on Shia Islam, but it was more centralized than Sunni Islam. So it's a little bit more like integralism. Sunni Islam is very congregationalist in its way. So Confucianism is the most anti-democratic, hands down. It's all meritocracy from top to bottom. I wanted to look at the different elements of these new theories, these new sort of treatises coming out on advancing different versions of religious anti-liberalism and to see if they had an underlying thread. And another underlying thread is their opposition, not even so much to just democracy, but to sort of the culture of individual rights that they think is produced and the claim that the liberal state is somehow fairer or more neutral to differing points of view than their religious anti-liberal doctrines would be. So,
Yeah. And I'm sure as people are listening to what you're saying and describing these different political ideologies and theological undergirdings, there are quite a few similarities, whether strong or weak, to kind of the modern day projects of Christian nationalism. Yep. It would be closer to Sharia law, the Muslim state, North Korea, or some form of Chinese nationalism under Buddhism than the American project. That's what we're working with here. In order to promote homogeneity, you need to oppose heterogeneity. Spoken in simple terms, in order to achieve a single culture and people group, you need to get rid of anyone who doesn't look, think, speak, eat, or worship exactly like you do. Nationalism of any stripe cannot be Christian. Integralism, being the older, far more intellectually robust and coherent political system compared to so-called Christian nationalism. How has Christian nationalism taken the spotlight? How has it become where it is today? Dr. Valier concludes.
Well, there are far fewer Catholics.
Okay.
The Catholic Church has had a massive, you know, massive sex scandal of maybe the worst scandal it's had in centuries.
True.
So it's a great deal of its moral authority has decayed. Most of the major Catholics in public life, in many cases, are progressive, like Biden. And so it doesn't come up on the left. And on the right, most of these folks are following, in a big way, the Second Vatican Council, which sets anything integralist aside.
True.
In its document, Dignitatis Humanae, 1965. They're also huge fans of Pope John Paul II and Benedict XVI. And Pope John Paul II was, they were both pushing for religious freedom at the Second Vatican Council. And they also fought for religious freedom against totalitarianism. Benedict was also an intellectual critic of the confessional state, so the Catholic state, even though he was no what we would ordinarily call liberal.
No.
And Francis, of course, I mean, I mentioned briefly, he said in a private audience that integralism was a play. And since so many of the bishops have been appointed by those three men, and the Catholic Church has 5,600 bishops, not one of them is openly integralist. So those are the reasons it hasn't spread. Also, I mean, just for it to take root in American soil in terms of, you know, liberalism and democracy being so closely rooted, the main potential influence of these folks is among Catholic intellectuals on the right and what kinds of laws and policies they support. So, you know, we'll look at the difference between, say, a Catholic Joe Biden vice president and a Catholic Vance, J.D. Vance vice president. J.D. Vance is probably the closest thing to a list among congressional GOP. I would describe him as a Catholic, but I don't think he's an integralist. He may think, well, you know, maybe it's the right regime in some like very world. But he has headlined conferences. He did headline a conference with the integralists with Adrian Vermeule back when he was running for Senate in 2022 at Steubenville. It's called Restoring a Nation. Anyone can look it up. So what the heck is he? He's not getting money in Steubenville. He's not getting. So, Vance has been a lot. Different sort of these new radical factions on the right. So I don't think he's been particularly just doing integralist stuff, but, you know, all the same. So it is something to keep thinking about, because I do think, especially if Trump wins, the interest in post-liberalism among Catholics and Protestants will because these events really affect whose ideas get on top. So there wouldn't be any mass integralist movement at all if Trump hadn't been elected. I mean, there would have been about 20 people in a Slack chat talking about stuff. It was Trump that made it possible, because many of the integralists decided to get political when Trump was elected, precisely because they thought they could be more successful. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, 2024 is going to be a pivotal year for American liberal democracy. So.
Donald J. Trump. That's the key to the nationalist and integralist projects. They saw they're in. They walked through the door opened all those centuries ago. The exclusionistic and heritage American rhetoric, and beamed with success. An online community latched their wagon to Trump 2016, 2020, 2024, and whatever comes next. Because this movement is far from over, a society which is pluralistic, culturally heterogeneous, and accepting of various faiths, traditions, and backgrounds is the enemy which nationalism seeks victory over. It's been slowly growing, inching its way to cultural dominance. You won't see the fruits
of this even in the next election, but with a slow drip of policy change. That's where modern-day Christian nationalism comes from. Those are its roots. What began a small college town, Moscow, Idaho, with the vision of Jim Wilson and the slow but sure execution from Doug Wilson, building upon centuries of nationalistic political thought, is starting to crack above the surface, causing those tremors you heard about last episode. Now, we need to know what specifically this Christian nationalism is made of. Who are its forefathers specifically? What branches of the Christian tradition calls this political theory home? What kind of people espouse this? What sort of society is envisioned in this political program? We go next to Christian Reconstructionism. What has been torn down needs to be rebuilt. It needs to be reconstructed. See you then. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.